welcome to the Amber Data Derivatives Podcast. I'm here with Nick Forster for the second time, actually. He is the co-founder of Lyra, a DeFi options protocol that actually just launched their V2 version. Nick, how are you?
Doing well, thanks, Craig. How are you?
Yeah, doing great. It's really nice to have you on again. So you guys just recently launched V2 of Lyra, which has a lot of improvements and some substantial changes. I'm really excited to dig into all those details. For anyone who hasn't listened to our first episode together, maybe you could just give a quick background about yourself and you know, where you used to work before starting Lyra.
Yeah, sure. So I studied maths at uni and went off after uni to work as a equity options trader, a market maker at a firm called Susquehanna International Group. So I traded out of their U.S. Office in Philadelphia, making markets on single stock options. So really, really exciting place to work. Very cool place to work. They teach poker as part of their education. Around decision making under uncertainty and market making, got a firsthand view for all of the craziness and wild and wonderful ways people use options, and that's why I'm so convinced. Kind of leads us to Lyra and why we're so hell bent on bringing options to the crypto market at scale.
Yeah, absolutely. So you guys launched initially an options AMM, which was a very like innovative way to do options trading on chain. And you actually had a really successful AMM. It was like the only one that could actually trade options and not get wrecked for LPs. So now you guys have launched V2 this month and you guys made a lot of changes and you went from an AMM model to a central limit order book system. Can you maybe talk about sort of the reasoning behind that decision?
Yeah. So with the AMM, it handled every part of the options stack in one set of smart contracts. So it would set the price, it would handle margin, it would handle settlement, it would handle clearing, which is extremely cool, right? Like the thing that existed on chain ran itself, it auto-listed strikes, it generated vol surfaces on chain, and you know, people could trade against it and find a market clearing price for options. It was extremely composable. It was always on 24/7. Solana's doing really well right now, but back when FTX was collapsing, we were the only liquid market for options on Solana. LPs lost a little bit. I think they drew down 2%, but it wasn't nearly as bad as some had like feared with the model being there and exposed to adverse selection. But saying all of that, it's beautiful in one sense, but it's, you know, when you think about system design, having everything in one set of smart contracts is not the easiest way or the best architecture really to scale, because it means if you want to upgrade one thing, like how things are priced or how things are margined, you kind of have to think about the whole stack and then all of the different parts interact with each other. Makes it really hard to iterate on. It also makes it difficult, particularly for capital efficiency, because you have to program in kind of all of the rules around how it's going to handle margin upfront, which means you have to be really conservative with how you actually margin the thing. So for us, V2 really was about picking apart our assumptions around, you know, how can we build the best, most scalable experience, you know, not just for the first 3 months after launch, but also for years and years. Mm. So V2 unbundles some of those functions. So we've taken things that we really think matter on chain. So, all of the logic around, settlement, clearing, liquidations, how your marks are calculated, that lives on chain in the on-chain risk engine, which supports portfolio margin for options and cross margin for options and perpetuals, as well as some cross collateral features too. And we've unbundled that from pricing. So that's why, our vision for the future is around having many different forms of price discovery happening off-chain or potentially on-chain, and then committing through to the on-chain shared risk environment for settlement and clearing, as well as maximizing composability through all of that logic being on-chain. We can get into that later. But really, I don't think AMMs are going away. It's definitely a big part of how I see the future evolving. They provide users with enormous benefits relative to the CLOB model in some ways. It's 24/7 guaranteed liquidity. You have trustless marks for volatility that can't be manipulated, particularly in times of crisis, which is when, exchanges really, you really find out how an exchange behaves like five times a year, when things are going crazy. And then also They're really great actually at gracefully handling complex structured products because they can price them all atomically and kind of combine them in a way that, you would have to ping multiple RFQ providers or, you'd have to put out an RFQ, wait for responses on these multi-legged structures. You can just do that programmatically with AMMs. So AMMs will be back, but I see it as one of many matches that facilitate price discovery in the new V2 architecture.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So I guess the main selling point was that the AMM is always on. So that's really nice for a user of Lyra on V1. But now V2, you guys have done a really big leap forward with portfolio margin. So that's the trade-off, I guess, is now you can have portfolio margin. So maybe we could talk about that. How does the Lyra risk engine, handle being able to calculate everyone's margin requirements, the initial margin, the maintenance margin? And then how do liquidations work?
Yeah, great question. So the there is still like a in the V2 architecture, we have the portfolio margin risk manager, and we also have the standard margin risk manager. So like these are the two frameworks for margin. Anyone can spin up a risk manager. If you wanted to get really kind of you could change the parameters to be something more hyper capital efficient, but maybe a little more risky. And that doesn't necessarily share the same risk profile or collateral as the other risk managers, but that's getting ahead of the point a little bit. But with portfolio margin, the way it works is, as portfolio margin, you take a portfolio of assets like options and perps, you run it through a number of different scenarios, 27 in the sort of, I think, like in the traditional sense, like up, spot up 20%, vol up 50%, or spot down 20%, vol down. And then you take the max loss amongst all of those portfolios, and you essentially give to a trader, like, this is your margin. Like, you have to cover this max loss, which allows hyper capital efficiency. So for us, we can't perform all of those 27 checks on chain. There are some that like cannot be checked on chain, because if you do that, it just fills up too much gas within within a given block. So there is a trade-off here. But we perform three of those checks on chain. And then the DAO, the Lyra DAO, is eligible to like whitelist different order book providers that have to prove that they've run the remaining 24 checks on chain. But the three that happen, sorry, off chain, the three that happen on chain, so those are called risk assessors, by the way. And, people can apply for that and go through that process. But the three that are on chain are the most extreme. So they do provide a lot of guarantees around the actual solvency of the portfolio. But you can't like open insolvent positions or crazy portfolios, but the sort of 27 checks are, 24 checks are also formed off chain. So that's kind of how it functions. With the standard manager, it's a little different. A lot of that logic, most of that logic remains on chain, like all of it. And so, you can do these call spreads and different option structures and have that margin be reflected on chain because it doesn't have to go through those 27 different scenarios.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, is everyone eligible for portfolio margin, or is there like a whitelisting process? I'm not totally clear on that.
No, so there is no whitelisting process. It's part of the protocol. The protocol is, permissionless. In terms of I think the current user interface that exists for Lyra, the portfolio margin is, when traders sign up, they get a standard margin account. I can say that like there will be an interface for portfolio margin coming shortly. So traders will have the ability to use portfolio margin out of the box, within the next couple of months. But that's more of a UI issue, right? It's already built into the protocol. So if you can handle the smart contracts yourself, you are more than welcome to go spin that up.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it's really going to be which one you opt into using, whether it's standard margin or portfolio margin. But there's no, it's not like some of the exchanges in traditional finance where, for example, at Interactive Brokers, you need to have a certain account minimum to be eligible for portfolio margin and then apply for it. Here, it's going to be this is the interface for the portfolio margin contracts. This is the interface for the standard margin contracts. Is that right?
That's right.
Cool. So one of the interesting aspects about introducing leverage into an options exchange is the liquidation process. So how do you guys perform liquidations if someone falls below their maintenance margin?
Yeah. So this is I think, a place where we're beginning, just like I guess a small taste of like how we think we can start to innovate on the traditional finance stack. So if you compare it to like the traditional finance stack, and maybe I'm oversimplifying here, and feel free to correct me if I am, Greg. But the way it works is liquidations happen on one on like typically just on the order book. But the way that the waterfall works is, there's a series of, clearing houses that, backstop the ultimate solvency of a derivatives exchange, right? Which exists. Anytime you introduce capital efficiency, there's a risk that a position blows up and someone does not have enough collateral to offset their obligations. For most traditional exchanges, that ends with the clearinghouse. If the clearinghouse were to go down, there's a concept of, haircuts and taking, losses on gains potentially. But there's also this ultimate backstop of, well, like, who knows? It hasn't happened yet, but with push comes to shove, like there's like the government backstop as well. With DeFi, you don't have any of that. You don't have the ability to turn the contracts off and just stand there and sort of reallocate funds from people semi-arbitrarily. You kind of have to figure out a way to do that up front. So with Lyra V2, we have a innovative liquidation system, which I think is quite clever, and I think will really harnesses the benefits of being on chain and having a protocol, which is, when a user is insolvent, they drop below their maintenance margins. Well, not insolvent, sorry. They just drop below their maintenance margin. They have enough collateral to, capitalize their position. What happens is an auction process is kicked off. It's a reverse Dutch auction. So it starts by offering the users like portfolio of assets at a discount to the mark to market. It's like 5%. Anyone can come along and liquidate that user's portfolio of assets. It's all on chain. It's a smart contract. You can liquidate that portfolio and say like, yeah, I'll take that. I'll recollateralize the position and receive like a essentially a 5% discount to the mark to market for my efforts. No one takes that. That's fine. Like the discount continues to go up. So it goes from a 5% to a 10%. It goes really quickly actually out to a 30% discount. So there's a large haircut. So it's an extremely large incentive for the people to come along and liquidate because it's calculated relative to that mark to market. And if that so like that's the quick discounting period, so 5 to 30. If no one takes it, then it sort of slowly discounts down to 100%. Now, if it discounts down to 100%, no one's taking it, something's definitely off, right? Like it's not it's there's an insolvency, right? A user does not have enough collateral to fulfill their obligations. And that would kickstart an insolvent auction, which, so Lyra has an on-chain security module. Currently, all of the fees from the protocol are going to the security module. And that's essentially an insurance fund, and that's building up over time. And the security module's role at that point will be to pay people to take on this position. So, you actively get paid, you get the collateral that exists, and you get, $100 credit or a $300 credit, and that increases over time. Ultimately, the worst case scenario, right, is socialized losses if an insolvent auction fails to clear and there's a security module. So there's a algorithm that socializes users' losses in the system should all of those things fail. And that's obviously the worst case scenario. But we're on chain, we're in DeFi, we're trying to build better systems. That's riskier. But if you want to offer a product that's competitive, all of those rules are transparent up front, and those dynamics, will play out in real time. And so our bet here is that like the wider, because of the permissionless nature of the protocol, anyone come and liquidate, we can draw on the entirety of DeFi to perform liquidations, which I think increases the robustness of the whole setup. Lastly, sorry, I tend to ramble a little bit, but the last thing I wanted to highlight is I actually think this is a really nice mechanic for users because those liquidations happen transparently and they are not tied to the like instant liquidity on an order book. And when markets get crazy, what tends to happen is that market makers, they might find themselves as the only one out on the book, particularly on these less liquid exchanges. I mean, Lyra will be scaling up over the next couple of months, but for us in our current situation, that's also true. Like we're not above that. If you're, a market maker and someone's getting liquidated or auto deleveraged on your book, you can just move your quotes, and then set the price. It could be you can immediately go from a 5% discount to an 80% discount, and the user rocks up and they go, "Well, I was $2 under my margin, on a $1,000 position, and I now have $300 left in my account." And like that sounds like an exaggeration, but those stories happen, and that's what happens when those mechanics, like as I said, 5 times a year is those trading events, 5 times a year is what defines an exchange. fully rely on that as a mechanic, you definitely risk your traders losing out.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So it's like in a fast market, market makers pull their quotes, and that's the time when people get liquidated anyways. And so let's say I'm short a call. I don't want the liquidation system to just go and pay whatever price it, whatever the ask is when the quotes have been pulled to get me out of my short call, because then I'm essentially going to get scalped. Instead, we're going to take that position and we're going to auction it off. So we have a theoretical mark, and we're going to auction off at 5% from the Theo, 10% from the Theo, down to 30%, so on and so forth. And so now there isn't that pay through the book type of risk that you would naturally have in some of the other systems. That's really interesting. Now, one of the other things that I really like about your liquidation system is that it's not like this all or nothing liquidation. So I can actually free up some margin and not have like my entire portfolio liquidated just because I'm maintenance margin, when I could just like cover, let's say, a short call and then free up a bunch of margin. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So you could get covered by like your offset buying, anytime you can bring in to any portfolio like risk reducing assets. So if you're really short like some calls and you want to buy back calls with a lower strike or a higher strike, like that will always be allowed as part of your portfolio. So you can definitely rescue that. I will also point out that it's not necessarily if you are up for liquidation, liquidators can choose to liquidate like a small percentage of your portfolio, which really democratizes things. Because if you're a smaller like player in DeFi and you want to liquidate 10% of a big portfolio, you can piece off 10% and take it and liquidate it yourself, which also kind of improves the robustness of it. But yeah, going back to your point, like that's certainly true. Like you can always bring in risk reducing assets into your portfolio.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so let's just say I want to be a liquidator on the Lyra protocol, and I want to make that a business of mine or a business line of mine. Is there API calls I can make to see who's getting liquidated, or what portfolios are up for liquidation? How do I do that?
Yeah, so there's one of our core contributors wrote a script that like allows so the in the short term, I will point out it is like you won't be able to turn around and liquidate and then offload it. Like you can do this, you can merge it with an order book account, but we're still working on perfecting that flow where you can take a like a position that you've liquidated, merge it into your main trading account, and then trade it off on the order book. That flow is still a little difficult, but we're working on that like very shortly. But in the meantime, we do have a script that allows you to call, see the open liquidations that exist on chain, and potentially liquidate them yourselves. I would point people to our Twitter. We have bounties actually for the highest, like the people who perform the most liquidations over the first 3 weeks of being live.
Wow.
So we're 1 week into that. Not many liquidations so far, which is great.
That's great. And then one of the other things about a central limit order book is getting market makers on board. So can you talk about, how many market makers you guys have right now who are market making on Lyra, and do you have any sort of incentives for market makers to come online, and do they have like any requirements, like minimum quotes or minimum, I don't know, quote size, things like that?
Yeah, so the way we've set it up, we have an anchor market maker who is currently live. We're kind of rolling out the system, testing things with them, and onboarding other market makers. Once that's in, well, given that that's in production, it's easier to do. They can test in real, in prod themselves. But we have one market maker that's currently live. They have minimum obligations, and uptime obligations, for everybody. For outside of the anchor, we've designed a liquidity program for market makers, which allows, I think, promotes really healthy and good liquidity and competition. So we have two or three more like market makers that are testing in prod, as I mentioned, and like will come live in the next week or two. And then January 10, the way we've sort of done the rollout is to test the system, also reintroduce people to options. We've based it around, and we'll get into this later, I won't get ahead of myself, one expiry in Bitcoin, the Jan 12th expiry, to trade the ETF. And our goal is really to build up the volume, the system, test in prod, build up, get market makers onboarded, and then explode out on January 10th with the wider market making program, which incentivizes, I think, active good liquidity, And people, market makers only earn incentives if they're providing good markets. There are many different scoring metrics that we've built into the program and are assessing market makers with. So things around uptime, quality of quotes, like actually being active, taking in the market. And they really have to compete against each other to get the rewards. There's no like just payouts for being on the book. Like that doesn't exist. I think that promotes passive liquidity. It's all about how much volume are you facilitating, how good are your quotes, and how much competition there is on the book. So, I'm expecting, a fair few more on January 10 as well by that point, which is when we sort of publicly flagged that we're going live with the full suite.
Yeah, that makes sense. And just for clarification, a quality quote is something that's like a tight bid ask, or is it something else?
Yeah, tight bid ask, with size that is more than like some sort of minimum, right? Like you don't want people doing these tiny orders like 0.01 of a Bitcoin, like or super tight. That's not helpful, but like it's relatively tradable quotes at good spreads.
That makes a lot of sense. So one of the other things that you guys have been really innovative about is launching your own app chain. So this is a trend that I'm starting to see. I'm really excited to see that you guys have done this too. It's essentially an L2 that's dedicated to Lyra protocol itself. Can you talk about the app chain and the Lyra rollup and how does that work?
So we're really excited about this. I think it, I think one of the things we had problems we had with AMM really early on. I think we were the first L2 native project to launch on Optimism back in August 2021. We kept running up against the gas limit with all of the options logic. Options are really, there's a ton of financial logic. If you want to do it right, make them extreme, like. And there's a whole reason why I think options, I think they're due for a massive growth in the market, to normalize relative to traditional markets, but also it on, being on chain, being composable, being programmable unlocks a 10x for the options experience. And we can touch on that later. But the problem we kept running into having all of this options logic on chain, which facilitates that composability, is you keep running up against gas limits from all the compute. So you can't get enough, logic into the actual block. To be able to do all of these things on chain. So for us, moving to an app chain allows us to really not compete with other protocols for block space. But because we're on the OP stack, the OP chain, that allows us and will allow us to retain the composability element once the superchain architecture is live. So the OP superchain is a chain of chains. So like multiple different app chains like Lyra, there's other ones, Sora, Gitcoin have one, and of course Coinbase with Base. And so in the future, like, on their roadmap sometime in the next year or so, it's always hard to put precise timelines on this. The superchain, they all adhere to the same standards, of the chains. And that will allow us to atomically talk to the users on Base, right? Base users can, come on Lyra and buy a call seamlessly without switching chains in MetaMask or having to do bridging or anything like that. So that's the world we're building towards. And an app chain allows us to really do that. Control the things that we, the DAO needs to control around, not having to compete for block space. And we want to definitely build an ecosystem of apps on there that use options, build, programmable structured products and things like that on top of the risk engine that we've built. And, retain all of the things that we care about with DeFi, which is, self-custody, decentralization, composability. And that's really where I think the app chain helps us a lot.
Yeah, that's really interesting. One of the interesting things about app chains is to me, it seems like the organic scaling solution. Like it's like naturally occurring without necessarily, waiting on the Ethereum Foundation to figure out sharding or anything like that. So I find that very fascinating. I want to touch on account abstraction.
Oh.
Can you?
Yeah. So account abstraction. There are definitely a huge, there's a huge range of experiences that can be crafted, with account abstraction. And so like simply account abstraction is using smart contracts as the basis for wallets as opposed to, EOAs, which is the traditional way of Ethereum. Like you sign things, you approve transactions. With account abstraction, you can build, and I can't say who we're working with. We're building experiences that I think will allow a whole new swath of users to come over from traditional centralized exchanges to be able to use Lyra without necessarily needing to know that they're on a chain, they're getting all of the benefits of being on chain without necessarily having to do all of the hassles. So things like email, password, sign up, gasless transactions, which we have on the rollup already. So if you come on the rollup, essentially when you're paying trading for options and you're paying fees, a portion of that USDC fee that's coming out of your balance is being used to, convert it on the back end to ETH and being used to pay for your transaction fees. So to you as a user, like if you're okay with the fee, like it's the same experience as a centralized exchange. And that fee is only going to come down and down over time with EIP 4844 and span batching. So really, account abstraction, I think, is going to be once those features are fully implemented, it will be indistinguishable from a centralized exchange. And at that point, really, you're getting, again, all of those benefits of being on chain, and the novel like products that we can build on top of the risk engine, and composability and all of the assets and things that are getting tokenized that are, coming on chain over the next year without having to have the downside of, credit risk or, who knows what's going on in some of these, the cloud servers and no guarantees around your custody as well. So really, I think we can build better experiences in centralized exchanges now, and we don't really have an excuse not to. And so all of those features are coming live over the first half of next year, and I'm extremely excited to see how they go.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Another thing that's really interesting about the Lyra app chain is that you guys just launched a block explorer for it. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the block explorer is, definitely an important part of any app chain stack, right? Like users need to be able to see what's going on the chain in a user-friendly way. So for us, like you could do the same as like it's like our version of an Etherscan or an Arbi scan for Arbitrum. So you can come on, you can look at like, for example, the security module, you can observe that in real time. We're building interfaces to make that more intuitive, like on top of the Block Explorer. It's still it's a bit rough around the edges right now. We're only a week in, so you have to query some contracts directly to find that. But things like, the security module, insurance fund balance, you can look at all of these sorts of things if you have access to the Block Explorer, and you can dig through the data. So every sort of detail around the exchange, things like positions that are held, open interest, that's all available through the Block Explorer, and will be sort of made more readily available through some of the data analytics things that we're coming up with and cooking up in the background to make it even more accessible to users.
Awesome. I want to touch on the governance aspect a little bit. So obviously, Lyra has a DAO. Now, what's the difference between sort of the Lyra team, the DAO, the delegates, and like the owners of Lyra tokens who are staking and voting? Like, how is the DAO hiring the Lyra team? Like, how does that all work? How does the governance mechanism work, just as a kind of a bird's eye view?
Yeah, so the DAO has appointed a couple of different ends. So the way it works is like the DAO is a bunch of token holders. They hold the token. All of the DAO governance for Lyra is on chain. So they own the treasury. They own and they control all of these things via smart contracts. So it's a very, I think, like advanced governance system relative to a lot of the ones that exist in crypto. It's often caused a bit of pain because a lot of that logic happens on Ethereum mainnet, which does has gotten a little bit painful for gas recently. But the way that it works is the token holders essentially just appoint different independent service providers. So there's the Lyra Foundation, for example, and that's going out and essentially developing software for the protocol. And supporting the DAO's efforts for adoption of the protocol. So for us, like that is the method. It's kind of like a board of directors in a way. They can grant parts of the treasury to different contributors and to different entities to go out and do separate jobs. And if they're failing to do that, the DAO can obviously revoke that access or cut off those funds. And so like that's the way of holding accountability and operating. Normally, so those token holders are the ones that control every aspect of the protocol and the treasury. For us, that was the best example of that was how Newport was running in a way. Like it was running automatically. The protocol, required you just ran itself, listed strikes itself, and expiries, and token holders were there, with essentially being able to control treasury and nominate different entities to go and promote adoption. So really with Lyra token and the DAO, the DAO is a very decentralized entity in sort of a real practical way. And we see that as being a big role of the security for the Lyra chain and the protocol going forward. So the DAO, as I said, is currently opting to funnel all of the sort of fees generating on the protocol into the security module, improving the on-chain insurance fund that drives confidence and improves the protocol. It will control over time, like as we continue to decentralize like every aspect of the Lyra chain and the protocol and how we work out that governance, right? On like whether it lives on mainnet or eventually migrates to Lyra chain is still an open question. And that's something that I definitely think the DAO should be thinking about over the next few months. With respect to delegates, so instead of voting, so the way the governance works is a proposal gets put up by anyone. Anyone can submit a proposal. You need a certain amount of Lyra. I think it's like 10,000, don't quote me on that, staked Lyra to go and take that to a vote on Snapshot. Anyone can vote like yes or no on the proposal. That proposal has a on-chain action that's tied to it. So if it's a yes, some set of smart contracts will go off and do their thing. So for delegates, sometimes users want to be less involved in the day-to-day decision making, so they delegate to users who are or token holders who have put themselves forward to be a delegate, who can amass that voting power and make decisions on behalf of other people as well. So that can simplify a lot of the governance, and we've worked with Agora around implementing all of those governance procedures.
Yeah, that's really cool. So theoretically, like the DAO and the voters could elect to create a grant for someone who wants to build an RFQ system on the new V2 protocol, and then there would be like a grant to hire the developers and essentially build that out. Is that like a theoretical possibility?
Definitely. Yeah, absolutely. That's how we see it working. Like I think if you try to make the DAO too involved day to day on like decision making, right? Like it can be slow. Like you need to like I see the DAO's role as like empowering different subgroups to go off and implement things at speed and at scale. So yeah, that's definitely something I think that could work.
So let's talk about the trading competition. So with the V2 launch, you have one listed expiration for Bitcoin, which is the January 12th expiration, which is in line with theoretically the spot Bitcoin ETF decision deadline. And so how do we see that, and what is the trading competition, and where are those details?
Yeah, so as I mentioned before, like we wanted to do the rollout in a considered way and start with one expiry, sort of educate users, farm it for content in a way, and show people like how you can trade an options event using options and keep it very simple by focusing all of the attention onto one board. So the ETF decision is expected to come, either an approval or denial in between Jan 5th and 10th. So we chose January 12th as the right expiry, so you can put your position on, hedge your risk or whatever it is. And, when the event comes, it'll resolve in one way or the other. And, it should be like a good indication of, how to trade with options and drive a bunch of interest in that expiry. So around that, we have created a competition where users can come and trade options and also trade perps and lead up to the ETF approval, subject to, of course, like the terms of use in the app. Like there are certain jurisdictions that are prohibited, but if you're eligible to come and do that and trade, you can go do that on the interface for the protocol, and so you can come trade if you earn by like essentially your volume that goes through the protocol, and you do get a boost as well based on whether you're profitable or not. So you get like a 20% boost if you happen to be a profitable trader, which is it incentivizes kind of like the organic aspect of that as well. So we think it'll be like a really nice way to intro people to the protocol, to options more generally, and really showcase what they can be used for and their unique value prop relative to other instruments that are more popular in crypto. And then, once that's all resolved, explode out into like the full set of ETH and Bitcoin options.
And then you mentioned perpetuals there. So does the can the trader theoretically just decide that they want to do a perpetual trade and not do an options trade and still win the competition theoretically?
Yeah, that's totally possible. The purpose of that for people to trade. I don't want to be too opinionated on which one you should trade, but we want to make sure that people have the option and can kind of see, like, specifically around this event, right? Like if you're taking a position Friday, December the 22nd, when we're recording, maybe I shouldn't say that. I don't know, but like if you're taking that position now, right, like you still have to wait for, 2 or 3 weeks. You could just as well take that position in a week and a half and you'd have the same bet. Whereas if you think things are undervalued now, or there's some vol bet or distribution you're going to put on, you can lock that in, with options. And those are the kinds of things we want to draw people's attention to.
Yeah, and it's a really interesting time because, crypto vol events are still not well defined. This is clearly a vol event, but we've seen other ones in the past, such as the September 2022 ETH proof of stake merge, that had a huge implied volatility pump and a zero effect on realized volatility. It just kind of occurred and nothing happened. I thought that was very interesting. Shanghai upgrade had some implied volatility pump. I think it moved a little bit more in the realized side than the proof of stake merge, but still, I think disappointing for vol buyers. So it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out because I do think this is more significant of a vol event than proof of stake merge. Proof of stake merge to me is like it that matters to the crypto community, but that's a small pool of money amongst itself. This spot Bitcoin ETF theoretically starts broadening out the audience of people who will react to this news event, which includes people with actual big money who might be trying to get into Bitcoin once the spot Bitcoin ETF is approved in order to accumulate Bitcoin to potentially, I don't know, get some exposure until the ETF is launched and stuff like that. So it's very, very interesting. Well, Nick, congrats on launching V2. I'm sure that was a ton of work. I always like to ask these final questions. What have you been able to do outside of building V2, if anything, for fun? And then if you want to remind us of maybe one of your favorite trading books, we'd love to hear that too.
So God, like last 2 months, honestly, no, it's been no fun. Unfortunately, but it's been fun. Like it's actually been really, really fun working on the product. It's awesome having a product that you have full confidence in that you can kind of wake up every day and be like, yeah, like we can just keep throwing fuel onto this fire. I'm in Sydney at the moment. And so like, I'll be going to the beach, I think a little bit over the next week, as things slow down, hopefully in maintenance mode for a week and then come out the gates firing in, in early 2024. In terms of trading books, I mean, it depends where if you want like a very technical options trading books, right? Like the Hull derivatives textbook, as well as, Taleb's dynamic hedging, you can't go wrong. I know everyone cites that, so it's a safe answer. What I really think are interesting, I think, this is also kind of a safe answer, but it's somewhat underrated, is like thinking fast and slow. It's so overrated, it's underrated. We had to read about all of those cognitive biases for, when we're training as traders. And I think they do come in a lot of, they're extremely important when you're trying to assess, like, is this just a decision I have on a hunch? Or like, I might have an idea or a position, but like, why is the market getting it wrong? Like that's a really important framework to work through, is like, okay, like I have this idea. I think the Bitcoin ETF is going to get approved, but like, why is my position going to be better than the market? So like, where in this distribution can I target that I think they're over or underpricing? And again, like having that insight, is, and options really are the best tool to express that, in those sorts of insights. So, for me, it's just about like getting better at making decisions, and particularly decision making under uncertainty. So being able to, master that aspect and be aware of the common psychological pitfalls in decision making is really important outside of the purely like technical quant kind of math stuff.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Nick. Really learned a lot. I appreciate you coming on again.
Thanks for having me, Greg. I enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely. See you, everyone.